The talk this afternoon, first one, it's about improving emotional intelligence. How many here are familiar with the term emotional intelligence? A few people. Okay, very good. There was a very famous book actually entitled Emotional Intelligence when this first came out, I think over a decade ago. And it's something that actually, once we come to realize it, it has everything to do with the health of the brain, and actually it's a powerful tool to help with depression. And so we're going to be talking about the frontal lobe this afternoon, and improving emotional intelligence is very much linked with the frontal lobe. And that's why we titled this talk, Improving Emotional Intelligence. It has to do with learning new ways of thinking so that we can change the way we feel, and we'll discuss a little bit. But before we get into that, I would like to just go over a few things that is a brief review for those of you who are here first time today, so you know what we talked about yesterday. Just as a review, lifestyle hits. We talked about exercise, importance of fresh air, deep breathing, and the importance of exercising, as well as being outside in the sun at least 30 minutes a day, as important things to do. We also learned that just knowing what we need to do to improve our health or improve our brain health, it's not enough. We actually go through a process of change. And so we talked about the stages of change, where you go from being unconsciously incompetent, or meaning you don't know that what you're doing is bad for you, from learning that, and then you become consciously incompetent, and then you choose to do something about it, where you actually put that into practice, and it's a conscious decision, even though your body or your mind may not like that, but you know it's better for you, so you actually go and you choose to do it. That way you become consciously competent, and then after that becomes a habit, unconsciously you choose the right thing to do. And this has to do with everything. Yesterday I gave an example of soda, but everything in our lives, we go through this process, even in terms of our thoughts and our thinking. You know, we've been talking about abuse and how sometimes women suffer a lot of prejudice or even abuse in many different ways. There are some men that don't believe that women and men are equal, and they actually use texts in the Bible or, you know, misrepresent certain ideas or concepts to put women down. And so they learn that because it's cultural or because they've always learned. And it's a process once they realize what Christ's message is all about. And this morning I was reading in the book Fundamentals of Christian Education how that little old lady we've been talking about sometimes that was inspired wrote how women should take her place of equality given by her to her by God, and actually, you know, perform the duties that God Himself gave women to do as a mother, as in her ministry. So to change that in the minds of maybe a few men or even some women that are not used to that kind of equality or that thinking or that concept, it's a process, and it's the same process. Once you realize what God's message is all about, what His, that's the story we just read about Mary and how He broke down all those traditions and those ideas. It's a thinking change, and it's a process that involves the stages of change. So this is just part of it, what we did yesterday, and we should apply that for our thinking as well. We talked about nutritional cause of depression, and you remember tryptophan being amino acid important in the production of serotonin. We also talked about omega-3, folate levels, and atherosclerosis, anorexia, weight gain as some of the issues related to nutritional hits for depression. I just wanted to, for a few minutes, talk about circadian rhythm since we didn't have time yesterday. And this has to do with our cycles of sleep. Actually, as you who have experienced depression may know or may remember, you go through very many problems related to sleep. Some people have insomnia, some people sleep too much. So the circadian rhythm is a very important aspect, and it's a category of causes for depression. People have regular insomnia where they just can't fall asleep. They stay late, up late, and just for some reason they can't rest. They sometimes can also sleep more than 9 hours a day. And that's not something they were used to. So that is a clue. Or they can sleep less than 6 hours a day when they normally wouldn't do that. That's another clue. And people that do shift work end up sometimes being as well suffering some of those issues with the sleep, as well as not having regular hours for sleeping and eating. That's a big clue. Some of us go to bed different times every day and we're busy, and that is in itself a hit for our brain. So depression and insomnia, the depression seems sometimes for some people to be better if you stay awake. And so they come into this cycle where they have more energy because they're awake, but then they get sleep deprived, and then when they sleep, they end up sleeping too much, they feel bad, and so sometimes they're in a zombie state the next day, and so it's a very bad cycle. And so there is a way of treating that. We mentioned to you here, I think yesterday or the day before, about the light. Oh, yeah, I had a light here. It was yesterday. So people that go through those cycles, if you wake up early in the morning with the sunlight and you go and you actually have 30 minutes of bright light therapy early, as soon as you wake up, and you actually, within the 10 minutes that you wake up, that if you do that every day, that will help to put your circadian rhythm back in shape and will help you sleep better. We're going to understand why. So the other thing is getting regular hours. Even if you don't fall asleep, plan to sleep at that time, and that will actually help you. Regular hours of sleeping, eating, exercise requires also sometimes an alarm clock at first, so you get up even though you want to stay in bed. So you have to kind of go through this discipline of actually trying to work through it until your circadian rhythm is back into shape. Three tips for people that have insomnia. If you can't fall asleep, first thing, you need to have a quiet place. No noise. There are some people that, okay, I'll turn the TV, the music. Actually, your brain, it works better if you just turn all the noise down and it's quiet. Second thing is for you to be still. Some people just move from one side to the next. They can't sleep. They keep moving. That's not going to help you fall asleep. And third, it's eyes closed. You need darkness. So if you stay still, closed, not in a hot environment, nice or kind of cool, and just stay there in a quiet, eventually you will fall asleep. So those are three tips, three factors that are important with sleep. We know that the pineal gland in our brain produces very important chemicals, neurotransmitters and other chemicals. The one that we want to highlight is serotonin, because we know it has to do with mood, influences our sleep, as well as has to do with the pain control that we have. And interesting, serotonin actually, in the presence of darkness, transforms itself into melatonin. Now, how many have heard of melatonin? Okay, melatonin is a hormone, and this hormone is the fix and rejuvenate hormone. Some people thought that if they had a lot of melatonin, they then will never get old, or their skin will be better. And indeed, I mean, when we're growing up, we have high levels of melatonin. We're rejuvenating, and you know, it's a wonderful process, and there's a reason for that. It fixes us, and you know, there's a whole process of production of melatonin as we're growing up. And as we get older, that diminishes. So this melatonin has a lot to do with the sleep cycles as well. Here, so just to have an idea, when we're young, from 10 years of age to 80, you can see the amount of melatonin that we have. And as we age, it drops. So people older, they sleep much less than a 10-year-old who sleeps all night, sometimes 10 hours, and it requires sleep. Now, what are the effects of melatonin? It protects us against free radicals. So it's protective against carcinogens, against herbicides, and even radiation. So you want to have good levels of melatonin. It also prevents to fight tumors because of that very reason. It delays some effects of the aging, because what we just told you is the hormone that rejuvenates us. So it delays aging and also enhances our immune system. So we want to have good levels of melatonin. It lowers the risk of osteoporosis as well for women. Now, throughout the day, our levels vary. Early in the morning, during the daylight, you know, we don't have a lot of melatonin. It's when the darkness comes, the sun goes down, that we actually start the production of melatonin. And so serotonin, which I was telling you, it transforms itself into melatonin. And you have all this production. If this happens at night, it requires darkness to happen in our body. So we know that if we sleep early, before midnight, it's better for us. We've heard that in this text here, that if you sleep 2 hours before midnight, it is worth 4 hours after midnight. So it's better to sleep at 10 and get up at 3 than sleep at midnight and get up at 5. You have more hours of sleep. And we all know that sometimes it's not what we are leaving, but we need to keep that in mind. Steps in the production of the melatonin, like I said, first thing, the pineal gland gets tryptophan, which is, remember, the amino acid from tofu and other foods that we talked about, that is transformed into serotonin, which is that chemical neurotransmitter. Then it needs light, as we talked about yesterday, for tryptophan to transform itself in serotonin, remember? Then, once tryptophan is converted to serotonin, because of the light that's present, and that's why light therapy is important and being out there is important, that then in the nighttime, the serotonin will then turn into melatonin. But a point that's important is that when you are outside, like we talked about yesterday, and you're getting sunlight on natural light outside, you have a better production of melatonin at night, even though you need darkness for that to happen. But just if you have artificial light, you don't get as much production. Like you see here in the yellow, somebody that has artificial light only gets a little bit of production, whereas someone who is outside and gets natural light has a peak production of melatonin. So that's an important fact. After that, as we mentioned, serotonin is converted to melatonin. It requires darkness, sufficient darkness, as well as vitamin B12 and calcium. And that's the perfect medium so that we can have that wonderful hormone, which is very key for us. These are some foods that are high in melatonin. So another way of getting it is getting foods that have it. And so oats, corn, they're very rich in melatonin. And you, again, you know, can have that source. Just as a reminder, we're going to give these handouts for those of you who've been here for 3 days. It's going to be all the information in the CDs. We know that stress impacts melatonin, caffeine, alcohol, and tobacco. As a matter of fact, caffeine, I know there's some people now that sometimes drink coffee or sodas or whatever. If you drink caffeine, it cuts your melatonin levels in a half for 6 hours. Just so you keep that in mind, just so you know. So it's important for us to know. There's also plenty of drugs or medications that we take that decrease melatonin. And just note that antidepressants is one of them. No wonder sometimes one of the symptoms of people that take antidepressants, they have trouble falling asleep. Or, you know, they have issues with melatonin because of other reasons as well. Habits that increase melatonin production, like we talked about, being exposed to natural light, sleep in darkness. So if you have a little light, you know, somewhere, you're not going to have an optimal production. You need darkness, total darkness. You need to eat foods that are rich in melatonin and tryptophan, like we talked about yesterday. And then restrict food intake in the evening, especially practicing fasting. That is actually a better way of having highest production. So that was just something that I want to make sure that you knew. We didn't have a chance to talk about yesterday, but I just wanted to tell you today. Right now, we're going to be talking about the very last cause, which is the frontal lobe. And I know, how many here have heard about the importance of the front lobe? Okay, a few people have. And that is very much connected with emotional intelligence. So we'll be talking about that. But before we get into the actual emotional intelligence part, and by the way, this talk and the next talk after the break, they're actually one talk. It's all about the same topic. We are just going to have a break in between. But first, we need to understand the power of the brain. And it's amazing. This little 2-pound, most average, 2-pound little organ that we have in our, you know, in between our bones here in our head. 100 billion nerve cells are present. And we know that more supporting cells are also there. So it's many, many billion cells, thousands of different neurons. Unlike any other part of our body, in the brain, we have over 1,000 different cells. They're not alike. So we learned yesterday about the anatomy of the habits, how we create habits. Remember how we talked about every time you do that one thing, you create more of these little boutons here, and then you get a stronger pathway going. So this is the neural cell, and what happens is it gets information through the dendrites here, and it passes it along the axon all the way to the buttons, boutons in, at the end. So this is actually a little bouton, or what you can call, we call it synapse, because it's where the communication occurs. This is one cell, a little bouton there, or, and then the next receptor cell on the dendrite is a receptor nerve. They don't actually touch each other, but they communicate with little chemicals. So one of these here could be serotonin, another one could be dopamine, another one could be epinephrine, glutamate. They go in between, you know, communicate their drop down and communicate with each other. This is how everything happens in our brain. So when you're doing something, when you're thinking something, when everything that we do, it happens through this process. And this is the synapse. You know how many we have of those in our brain? We have, first of all, over 1,000 connections. Each cell connects with all other 1,000 cells. You can imagine how many of those little buttons are there, right? Boutons. And we have on one cell, this one here, the Purkinje cell, over 200,000 connections to other cells. So you can see how intricate this is. How complicated. It's the most complicated structure we have in our body. So we have about 100 trillion of those little synapses that the communication goes back and forth. Isn't that amazing? How powerful this is. This is just an assumption, an estimate. It could be 10 times as more. But the interesting thing that I wanted to point out is that most of all these connections happen in the frontal lobe. When you look at where are these happening, most of them, because as you know, we have several lobes in our brain, and the frontal lobe has most of all the connections that happen compared to the others. We know that the frontal lobe is a huge hit for depression, and actually, it's a seat for spirituality, as we talked about yesterday, morality, as well as the will. The frontal lobe is also the seat for the reasoning. When you're thinking through and making a decision, you using all those little connections in the frontal lobe. And when you are actually yourself, that you can identify your way of talking, your way of, if you're extrovert or introvert, whatever your personality is, it's all in your frontal lobe. How do we know this? I'll give you an example in just a minute. But this is some research that's been shown on someone depressed right here and after they've recovered from depression. Research has shown, especially in the last 10 decades, you know, 10 to the 20 years, that when you're depressed, as you can see here in the frontal lobe of your brain, you have poor circulation in the frontal lobe. And once you recover, see how it lights up much better? So there's much less blood flow in the frontal lobe in depressed people when you compare to regular people. And when you improve depression, circulation improves. And that tells us that we should then learn how this happened and what can we do to improve the circulation in the frontal lobe and avoid things that actually dampen the circulation or create a problem. Which one comes first? Some people say, well, maybe we're depressed, and then the frontal lobe ends up having a problem. But actually, this guy, Drevets, he actually did some research, very compelling evidence to show that that's actually not what happens. First, you have a frontal lobe injury or poor circulation, and then depression results. And we're going to be talking about some examples, but this is very documented now, and we know that's why frontal lobe is one of the category of causes for depression. Do you mind closing the door for me, please? So here are the frontal lobes of the brain, all the lobes of the brain. It's about 5 lobes. And I just want to tell you, so you can start understanding this. Cats, if you look at their brain, 3.5% of their brain is the frontal lobe. Very tiny. Why? Well, reasoning, I don't know if cats really reason a lot, do you? they have a few choices, but we know that they don't, it's very simple living. They don't have to be in this very complicated world with all these things that they need to do. They do have a little personality. I think all of them have almost about the same, but it's very minimal. Dogs, a little more. 7% of their brain is the frontal lobe. Monkeys, 17%. But when you come to humans, 33% of our brain, a third of our brain, is central lobe. So the effects of when something happens that affects our frontal lobes are several, and it brings quite a bit of impairment. First, your moral principles are impaired. So you can't really choose between right and wrong very well. When you have compromised your frontal lobe, you're socially impaired. People become numb, kind of, and they lose sometimes the empathy, the love for their loved ones in the family. You can also have lack of foresight. You can have problems with abstract thinking. As a matter of fact, you know, kids, when they're growing up, they don't have that. Their frontal lobe is not totally developed, so you can't come to kids and give them, you know, two abstract concepts. They can't grasp that because they're still improving and learning little by little. Their brain it starts to develop, and their frontal lobes get to where it needs to be. But that doesn't happen until they're not adolescent, and then they start later on getting more abstract thinking. Mathematical capabilities is diminished if you have a central lobe problem. Loss of empathy, like I mentioned, and lack of restraint. Suddenly, you know, these people start doing things that they were not actually able to do before. And an example is this guy, Phineas Cage. How many have heard his story? A few have. He was a worker at railroads up in Vermont in the U.S. in the 1800s. Late 1800s. And what they used to do is they used to have to make a hole, drill a hole in some of the rocks, and then put explosives, put some sand, and with a steel rod, you know, make sure that it was nice and tight, and then they would lit up the explosives and blow so that they would make way and then build the railroads. So what happens with Phineas Cage is that one day he was doing that, but in the process of getting the steel rod and really putting the sand in to make sure it was nice and tight, that process kind of lit up the explosive, you know, because of the friction, and that thing exploded, and the steel rod came through his face. And this is what happens. This is just the process. It went through his face here and all the way up his brain. Okay? The interesting thing is that he didn't die. He was alive. And it, just what happened, though, he had an accidental lobotomy, meaning his frontal lobe was impacted and he pretty much lost quite a bit of his frontal lobe. So they took him to the hospital. He survived. He was fine, and he was blessed, really. He didn't could have lost his eyes, vision, and anything, but it was fine. He was breathing. He was walking. He was back to work. But they've noticed a big difference. First of all, before, he was a faithful man. He was a God-loving, fearing man who used to go to church, very involved, loving family, loving husband, loving father. Had a wonderful life, and he was known for his integrity. This man, after this happened, he totally changed. Suddenly, he lost interest for spiritual things. He stopped going to church. He started cursing at people, things that he would never do before. He suddenly started doing other things, leaving home, suddenly showing more and more to his wife. He didn't care, and he left his family. He left his job. And he disappeared. His personality changed. He was like a totally different man. And to this day, his skull is up in this museum, I think near Harvard. But you can actually see Phineas Cage because they started studying. Oh, so what? The only thing that happened was the frontal lobe. And he made this huge impact in him. So that's when they started more and more doing research and finding out. So what are the things that actually the frontal lobe needs to to be healthy, and what are the things that impair the frontal lobe. Once we learn that, we can maximize this beautiful gift God gave us, which is the frontal lobe. One of them is nutrition deficiency. We learned that carbohydrates are the fuel of the brain. But we also learned that there's good carbohydrates and bad ones. And so we have to make choices. We need them and we need to choose. We know that the superior diet for the brain is actually, you know, the carbs that are plant-based and that are rich in fiber. We have here fruits, we have vegetables, there's, you know, whole grains, and also nuts are all very important. You know about omega-3s, the almonds, and the walnuts. They're all very important foods for the brain. There's a study that's shown, and you've probably heard that, when you give actually just sugar or candy to kids, they don't perform as well in school. And there's a reason for it. Their frontal lobe is impacted because of the sugar. So we know that that's not the best fuel for the brain, the best carbohydrate. Also, we know that the arachidonic acid decreases the ability of the brain. And that's present in all types of meat or animal products. So we don't want that. So we have a study in the United States, Dean Ornish, he's not an Adventist, and he was one of the first ones that started doing lifestyle hard trials on patients, putting them on a vegetarian diet, helping them quit smoking, helping them exercise, and seeing if they could reverse their cardiac disease. And interestingly, what they found, besides the fact that they were able to reverse the diseased arteries, they learned that these vegetarian patients were improving their mental well-being and experiencing more pleasure and less depression as a result, which he didn't expect. So we do know that the best diet for the brain, based on all the research that's done, is a vegetarian diet. And more and more research has been showing that. Second thing is, and we're going to spend more time on this on the second lecture, huge. And that's what Vicki Griffin's been talking about yesterday and the day before. All that happens in our brain, it's about cognitive distortions. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time now, but we're going to talk about that in a lot of time, detail. Hypnosis, something very problematic for the brain. You know, there's stop smoking programs based on hypnosis and all kinds of things. And people seem to be very successful at it. But this quote comes out of an actual book that teaches you how to hypnotize people. And this author wrote this, that hypnosis attempts to cancel out frontal lobe functions and bring people into a trance which they are highly suggestible. So this is the definition they gave for hypnosis, is where you cancel out your frontal lobe. No thinking, you make no choices. Somebody makes the choices for you, tell you what to do, and you follow. This is mostly easily accomplished by training the eyes to focus in one object, the best object being a little flickering light. Just flickering, flickering, and then people eventually would get hypnotized and ready. The person will record information and duties without interpretation and without frontal lobe activity. So when you're being hypnotized, there's no frontal lobe activity. Somebody else is taking care of your brain and telling you what to do. Now, we may not know, but do you know most of us have something at home that has the same effect of hypnosis? Anybody can guess? Television. Very good. There's plenty of data telling us that television, you know, there's negative impacts. We do know that people, when they're watching TV, it's like they're dreaming awake. They're also diminishing their own creativity. They're decreasing their interest for reading. After you watch something, it's very hard for you, okay, let me go and study now. You know, you have to make a choice. Some people do that. But you have to really make a choice. Normally, your brain is kind of like in a state of just, you know, almost sleeping. Decreases interest in learning, decreases discernment, and actually, it's a type of hypnosis. Why? Because, you know, there's a certain level where the scenes in the TV, they change very, very often. You know, flickering light? It's like they're flickering. And so when they measure people, frontal lobe, ECG, or electrocephalogram, and then they look at the waves in the brain, they see that the beta waves when you watch a TV, which is the good waves that you want to have, because you make, you know, you think and everything, they are transformed into alpha waves in just 3 minutes of being there watching. So some people find it relaxing. Sure, you don't have to think too much. You're just absorbing what you're getting, and you're almost in a state of hypnosis. In the sense that what you're receiving, you have to really think through, is this right or wrong, or am I going to be a choice here? But your brain is a little bit diminishing the capacity of your frontal lobe. So science tells us that TV teaches you not to think, increases aggressiveness. We know several studies have shown that. Decreases violence sensitivity. So suddenly you're okay watching certain things and seeing certain violent acts because you're used to it. Creates dependency. So there's plenty of reasons why we need to be very careful with the TV that we have. Number four that impacts frontal lobe, music. We know that music enters our brain through the temporal lobes and limbic system, which has to do with our emotions. And that's why you remember the song when you were, the first day when you met your boyfriend, your girlfriend, and you were going out on a date, and that song stays with you. And it's special. It's in your memory, but also it links to your emotions. After that, a few of the songs, some of the music, depending what you listen to, goes and moves to the frontal lobe of the brain. And it can influence the will, the moral worth, and your reasoning power. And actually, you know, there is wonderful research done by some people, I know here probably in Europe as well, but in the U.S., I think even in Oklahoma, the person that's more known and has published more about this is a lady who has studied music therapy and how that helps depression and how that helps the brain or improves brain function or anxiety and all that. So there's music that helps and there's music that impairs the frontal lobe. I think you can guess. For one, people think that if they listen to an upbeat music, they're going to feel better. So if you listen to an upbeat music, you know, it's going to give you a good sense, and so you're going to feel happier. But actually, research tells us that upbeat music is not necessarily uplifting music. So some types of music actually evoke very little response from the frontal lobe, which these ones that have, you know, syncopated rhythms do. Very little response from your thinking, from your reasoning. It goes directly and creates an emotional response, but it doesn't go through your frontal lobe. It's very little moral interpretation, and so you actually numbing your frontal lobe a little bit. However, we know that there is good music. This gentleman, Alvin Toffler, he's been known to be involved with all kinds of programs to get people. He's involved in commercials and getting people to buy into certain things. So he wrote this about the impact of music and constant stimulation on the senses. That constant stimulation of the senses shuts down analytical processes and ultimately shuts down the ability to face life rationally. This leads to escape techniques that involves withdrawal apathy, rejection of disciplined thinking when faced with difficult duties and decisions. So if you are those people that need to be constantly stimulated and music and TV and this and that, think about this. Of course, you know, there are people that need noise and they think that helps them work better. But actually, if you think of this, according to this man and some other writers, the more stimulation you get, the more difficult it is for your frontal lobe to actually focus and do its work. So we do know the good classical music uplifts your spirit. And that's why we had classical music before, after our classes here, as you remember. So music therapy in this particular study, which people are encouraged to reflect on their past, present, future while listening to classical music, improves mood and relieves stress. And this is the study that was done. They did 6 sessions of classical music therapy over a 12-week period in people that were 23-year-old and 45-year-olds. And after these 12 weeks, they showed that people had improved scores on their overall mood, so they felt better. They reported feeling less depressed. If they were depressed, there was less depression. And they reported less fatigue, as well as the measurements of better cortisol levels. You know, cortisol, as we talked about yesterday, if it's high, it gives you stress, it impairs your immune system, it's a bad thing. We don't want to have high levels of cortisol. And classical music decreases our levels of cortisol. So this was all shown this and published in the Health Psychology, you know, almost 20 years ago. It's not new. And it's really not new because over centuries ago, we remember the story of a depressed person in the Bible, King Saul. And David was called to play harp for him. And he would then feel refreshed from his sadness and his deep depression. So that's something that we should encourage. Actually, I should say to you that in this last depression recovery program we had, there was a lady that hated classical music. And that was one of the very difficult things for her to do. And she's like, no, I don't like that. But she started listening. Half an hour every day was the treatment. And at the end of the session, she told me, I shared this, that she said, you know what? I feel so better now. It's my favorite type of music. And she said, my kid on the back, she had a little five-year-old girl who, anytime she would change the music, she's like, Mommy, put the other music with the violin. And the kid was asking her to put it back. So it's very interesting and it does help. So if you don't, if you're not used to, try that and you see the difference that it can make. And the very last thing is going against one's conscience. You know that we talked about guilt and inappropriate guilt. And this also impairs our frontal lobe. And I can tell you personally, I did also have some periods of depression in my life, one period. And it was directly related to this. I was dating somebody who wasn't truly a Christian. And I felt very, very bad of the relationship. And that took me into a depression. And I was able, with God's grace, to be free from that. But I know that when you're doing something that you know is not God's plan for you, you're going on the wrong path. So it's something for us to think about. We need to ask Him to really lead us into the right direction so we can make good choices. So again, definite frontal lobe hits. Alcohol, nicotine, illicit drugs are all bad for your brain. That's a no-brainer, right? We know that that is bad. Low carbohydrate diets, frequent sexual arousal, actually people that have addictions to pornography, or any sexual conduct outside marriage, it's all going to impact their frontal lobe. People that watch MTV, I don't know if you have that here in the U.S., it's those videos, the music videos with all those scenes and the music syncopated and everything impacts. Under, of course, undergoing hypnosis as we saw. And also, no scripture study or abstract thinking has a huge impact in the brain. So we need to constantly be doing that. Habitually going against your conscience is the last one. This is a little summary. But what can you do to improve your frontal lobe? You need then to first protect it against injury. We do know that people that have, like I said yesterday, accidents and they go through injuries like that, they have a higher chance of developing problems with their frontal lobe. So you want to avoid that. Supply yourself with good oxygenation. So those deep breathing exercises that we did and we're going to practice in just a minute really help our brain and oxygenate our brain. Give yourself good nutrition. Get sunshine outside. Try to learn something new. This will stimulate your frontal lobe. New language, new hobby, new, you know, instrument, something. Learning improves and creates new cells in our frontal lobe. And that's very key. Prevent or control disease that will impact your brain, such as strokes and things like that. And we also know that a strong religious faith has a huge impact. And we know that our devotion, spending time with a close relationship with God is huge. This study was done, several studies at the American Journal of Psychiatry. Dr. Harold Koenig wrote about depressed patients, that they not only had less risk of depression people that have faith or people of faith, but they also recovered much faster than people that don't have faith. So there you can see why, because of the frontal lobe connection. So it's very important. Nothing so calculated to enlarge the mind and strengthen the intellect as the study of the Bible, someone said. And I think that was inspired. No other study will so elevate the soul and give the vigor to the faculties as the study of the living oracles. So this is very, very key. So do you want to have all these wonderful things in an optimal frontal lobe? Have more intelligence, analytical thinking, making good decisions. So what we need to do is to be transformed. Let God transform your mind and not be conformed to this world.